Good to see you all today. It is my privilege to introduce our speaker, not just this morning, but for this week. You've already heard him. My friend, Dr. Chris McGuffey. Good doctor here today. Chris McGuffey, better known as Guff, is a DTS graduate from the class of 1993. And he spent the better part of his career with CRU, Campus Crusade for Christ, overseas helping to pioneer campus ministries in creative access countries. Having helped raise indigenous staff in the former Soviet Union, East Asia, and Greece, Guff's academic interests led him to complete his doctoral work in strategic leadership in 2013. Guff now serves as the pastor of ministry strategies at Grace Bible Church, also known as DTS South, where he has the privilege of investing in the development of key ministry leaders, helping to formulate church-wide strategies for discipleship and engagement, and piloting a church planting residency. He's been married to his wife, Amy, for 25 years, and they have three Texas A&M Aggies. Now, this says simultaneously. Does that mean you're still paying? Freshman, sophomore, senior. We need to have a special session for any parent that is working their children through college all at the same time. But what a privilege it is, and I want to say this as a friend and colleague in ministry that have worked together, Guff's authenticity and transparency in his presentation is very refreshing, and it challenges your heart, and we are in for another treat today. And what a privilege, brother, to have you on campus with us for this entire week in this environment. Thank you for investing here at this moment, at this time. We greatly appreciate it, and we appreciate you. Would you please join me in welcoming Guff today?
Appreciate that this morning. On my first summer trip to the USSR, the former Soviet Union, I was placed on a team of 12 guys. The people in charge called it a scouting trip, which turned out meaning that they had no idea where we were going. Literally. Our initial instructions were clear. They said, in terms of packing, if you can't pick it up and run with it for 100 yards, don't bring it. And in terms of food, they said, buy some at the train station because we don't know if your train has a dining car. Looking back into this missiological venture the first time out, it should have been a warning sign. So in June of 1988, I landed in Moscow with 11 new pre-assigned friends, a backpack, and a brand new guitar. And I boarded a train that would last 9 days to travel across all 11 time zones of that massive communist country. And you ask, what do you do on a train for 9 days? And I literally learned how to play my new guitar. There are so many amazing stories from that summer, but one that sticks out really has very little to do with what happened in that summer in the Soviet Union. But as we got all the way out to the Far East as an American, they wouldn't let us go to Vladivostok because that's where the missile base and the nuclear subs were. We had to stop one short in a town called Khabarovsk. And I had the opportunity to look out across the Amur River and stare into the Manchurian hills of China. And I had a fleeting thought that said, I just wonder what it would be like to one day do ministry in East Asia. It seemed like pretty short. 8 years later, I was done with my seminary work. I had joined staff with CRU, and we had I had been newly married, packed our bags, and we moved into one of the most fruitful ministries in modern missiological history. By the time we left 10 years later, we were certain of a couple of different things. First is this, is that the fruitfulness that we had seen had absolutely nothing to do with our abilities. It was something that God allowed us to see because of our availabilities. And second, God was wanting us to see something so spectacular that we could steward that experience into later places. Over our lives, we took some funny turns into our next assignment as we left this place, which I would call one of the most fruitful fields, and ended up in one of the more fruitless fields of Western Europe. See, we left our beloved role in East Asia because the role that I had as one of the regional directors was ready to turn over to a national staff, and that's why we went there, to help create an indigenously led ministry to their own people. So as Amy and I began to think about what we wanted to do with our life, we kind of made that short list of criteria, right, of what is it that we would want out of a next place to serve. And the first thing we decided is that we wanted a place where we could help pioneer another ministry. In my past, I had stood in front of this sign that had Romans 15 emblazoned across it, and there was still weighing heavy on my soul to aspire to teach and preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named, where I would not build on another person's foundation. We wanted a place where we could use our giftedness, connecting with students in the USA to build ongoing partnerships, to help build staff-directed and student-led ministries where leaders could be raised. And we wanted to be able to steward the lessons that we had learned in East Asia, building a ministry that could be indigenously led to reach not only their own nation, but to the countries that surrounded that nation. And last, we wanted a place where the food was good and the weather was warm. Maybe not so spiritual. So we ended up ripping our boys out of their national schools where they had begun to become more fluent in the language, hopped on a plane and re-registered them in Greek public school in kindergarten, first and second grade. And I still remember the first day of school in Athens. We took our fellas down to the courtyard of the school, not really knowing what was happening, and had them blessed by an Orthodox priest with an olive branch and some holy water along with all the other kids. And with a very different situation from where we had come, we turned them over to a school system that we knew very little about. We walked back to the house. We sat down at our table, and I watched my wife cry for the next 3 hours. The question in our minds is, what are we doing to our kids? But you have to understand something about my wife. I told you yesterday, she's not much of a crier, and here I've told two stories where I'm probably going to get in trouble when I get back home. She was not doubting our calling. She was not doubting me. She was more than a willing participant wondering if the cost of following Christ into the harder places on earth was going to bear positive spiritual growth in the lives of our primary disciples, our kids. And I thank God every day that she has been with me on every step of faith that we have done and taken together. I wish I could tell you that the many ways that God grew us during those days and grew us as a family during those years, and how my kids in those moments learned to love Jesus. And now, all three of them attending the university simultaneously are considering how the Lord may use them to help build his kingdom. In so many ways, the journey in Greece was so much harder than the journey in East Asia. Where before we were seeing 20% of the students that we had shared Christ with come to accept him and begin a new faith, the time in Greece at the beginning, there was almost none. I asked another worker there what percentage of the people had trusted Christ in his ministry, and his answer kind of shocked me because he said, "I don't know, because you can't divide by zero." It was a very different field. By comparison, in our Oldfield, we saw more students come to Christ on one campus in 1 year than our organization saw in the whole campus ministry of Western Europe combined. And it was a statistic just like that that became compelling for us to go. Because while some move towards fruitfulness, someone has to move towards fruitlessness. When I connected with other Greek staff in my own organization and I shared my vision for pioneering a campus ministry in Athens, one worker literally said, he said, "Welcome to Greece, the country that takes big dreams and turns them into little nothings." And again, a fire lit in my belly. Because I knew that the fruitlessness wasn't determined by how hard I worked. It wasn't determined by the creativity of my strategies or even the knowledge of scriptures. East Asia had taught me that much. It was determined by whether or not I was willing to pray hard for God's mercy, be available when it came, and to try really hard not to screw it up. My hope was founded in the fact that the fruitfulness that we had just seen above the surface was a 10-year culmination of 100 years of prayer that happened in East Asia below the surface, and that God could do it again. So we prayed that God would give us the courage to minister in fruitless fields, not knowing if we were in year 3, 33, or 93. And we took confidence that in the places that were already white for harvest, somebody had done the work to move the rocks to create the field. And that moving rocks for the Lord is honorable work. So that's what we did for the first couple of years, at least, that we were in Greece, is that we learned how to design a relevant campus ministry around non-believing, culturally orthodox students. There are so many times that I wanted to quit. So many times I just wanted to go back to East Asia, where I already knew the language and I already knew the ministry context. And many times I just wandered around my neighborhood, out running errands, looking for apartments, looking for opportunities, looking for ways to get a legal visa, looking for ways to just get internet, and often asking, "Lord, did you bring me here for this?" To hear him whisper, "Yes, I did, but also more." Just to give perspective, we showed up to pioneer a new campus ministry, and when we arrived, we found out that the students of Greece had gone on strike in October 1st, shut down, locked up the universities, and it was a strike that lasted the next year all the way until Easter. Great way to start a campus ministry. No students. Recently, we've been talking a lot, I'm assuming, about the difficulties of these last 2 years, 2020 and now into 2021. And it was just funny because as we reminisce, most of the people that have been on the mission field just want to remind you that the rest of the world suffers these inconveniences for most of their lives. Pandemic? I was in East Asia when SARS hit. Snowmageddon? I lived through a Moscow winter. Electrical and water shortages? Don't even get me started. Internet? It took me 108 days to get internet into my house in Greece when there wasn't anyone on strike. Life runs at a different pace. But let me tell you a little ministry secret, a little missionary secret. In the places where hard ministries exist, your questions begin to answer themselves. Why am I here? This is hard. I'm here because this is hard. Why am I here? This is too expensive. I'm here because the cost is high. Why am I here? Because no one wants to come. I'm here because no one wants to come. Why am I here? It's too hot or it's too cold. I'm here because other people think it's too hot or it's too cold. Why am I here? The people are unresponsive. I'm here because the people are unresponsive. And why am I here, and what will it take? I'm here to do whatever it takes. And while this is a missionary secret, it applies to just about any difficult ministry context. I am here to tell you that the hardest places are calling out to us. I'm here to tell you that hope survives. I'm here to tell you that the sacrifice is worth it. And that God has given us the opportunity to carry the gospel to those who don't even know that they need it. And that's the challenge that sits at our feet. The title of my talk today is a little strange. I call it The Killer Ands of Acts 1:8. The Killer Ands of Acts 1:8. Now, after having come up with, at least in my day, 100-plus observations of this passage in BE 101 and what Aggies would call the old Army days, I'd be pretty foolish to try and sneak one more in on you. But I would like to remind us of the power of the little words in the Bible and the implications that they have on our ecclesiology and in our missiology. So let's read our passage together in Acts 1, starting in verse 6. Says this. So when they had come together, they asked him, "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" And he said to them, "It's not for you to know the times or the seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by with them in white robes and said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven." We learn right here at DTS, one way to synthesize a passage is to rewrite it in our own words. And thinking at the end, thinking of that scene at the end of the Jesus film, right before Matthew's hat gets blown off by the power of Jesus' ascension. If you haven't watched the Jesus film in languages that you don't know, you need to. You'll find many other things to look at, right? But as his hat blows off at the ascension of Jesus, this is how I would summarize this passage in my own words. The disciples say, "Lord, when is all of this tragedy going to end?" And Jesus said, "That's not really any of your business, but I have given you some things to do. I want you to go near, and I want you to go sort of far, and I want you to go really far." And they stand around looking a bit dumbfounded, and the angels respond, "Stop staring, get busy." I don't know if I can call us normal, but I do know that we're a little bit literal. That's a hermeneutical joke. It's okay. It's a tough segment of humor, right? I know that we're literal, but we're not so literal that we think that we all need to move to Jerusalem. But for me, this passage comes back to, we understand what the work is, but oftentimes we don't pay attention to the scope of the work, and it brings clarity to the Great Commission. having been a missions and a strategy pastor at Grace Bible Church in College Station, I've had to put some thought into how we need to be committed to these strategies to Jerusalem and to Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth, making sure that we have an equal commitment or some form of commitment to each of these for equipping and helping people to take their next steps. And unless I have dramatically underestimated my impact here at WEC 2021, most of you will probably end up in a local church within the USA. But we still need to understand Acts 1:8 as a framework on which we can hang different strategies to reach all three of these audiences. And at the end, at least at my church, we're trying to orient every person around their own personal calling, helping them to understand different categories of audience that the Lord may be putting on their heart and helping to equip them to be more effective as disciple makers within those audiences. Here's the most important thing I'm going to say, and you need to get out a pencil and write this down. I haven't made you take many notes, but as your professor, get your phone out. It's going to be a little bit difficult. It's mind-blowing, okay? It's mind-blowing. Write this down. You will be tested later, maybe at the judgment seat of Christ. That is a major grade. LLWP / EISE / M. It's pretty catchy, right? You can use that for free, but I reserve the book title. Okay? LLWP / EISE / M. As a teaching tool, I've given you a mnemonic to help you learn it. Laugh loudly, why pastors enter seminary education. Ministry. Right? What does this stand for? First thing, what I think that God is asking us to do is to have an impact in our Jerusalem. Those are people that are near you, and most likely, people that are like you. People that are near you and people that are like you. The first L is what we would call live. It's a neighboring strategy. It's focusing on those with whom we have either daily or weekly contact. The people that we pass by. The people that we can serve. That we can help, that can allow to help serve us. Okay, that there's that neighboring strategy of reaching out to just those people that happen by God's providence to live somewhere in our sphere of influence. The second L is learn. At least for us, because we have 70,000 students in our town, we have to develop strategies that are going to, in a relevant way, reach out to the students that are within our context. Okay, those that are learning in that area that are around us. The W is work. Here's that Faith at Work initiative, using current competencies as a platform for building kingdom relationships. Learning how do I talk to the guy in the next cubicle over? Or how do I share my faith with my boss in the context of my work? And the P is play. Ministering to people that gather together around us in our hobbies, in our affinity groups, in our natural spheres, whether it's soccer moms, motorcycle clubs, or quilting groups, if anybody still does that. The places where you choose to spend your time, how do we become ministers of the gospel to those that are near us and those that are like us? For me, the Judea and Samaria, and you could kind of split those apart if you wanted to, or you can leave them together. These are people that are near you, but that aren't necessarily like you. And we have to have a strategy that's more initiative to breach some of those cultural differences. The E stands for people of a different ethnicity. Reaching ethnic populations that have migrated into our locations, and we need to learn how to remove barriers to the gospels. And I am not just talking about whites reaching out to people of color. I'm not just talking about people of color reaching out to whites, but that everyone has their own little box that we all need to get out of and learn how to minister to people that are near us, that are a little bit different from us in our neighborhoods and in our communities. The I is for those that are in the international community. For us, that means the 6,500 international students that are at Texas A&M University that God has gathered from the ends of the earth and put right in our place. It includes the recent immigrants that have moved into our neighborhoods that are wondering what our culture and our holidays and our churches have in terms of any relevance for their lives. The third one is for those, the S is for socio, or people that have sociological differences from us. Helping people to see and move towards people that are running in different social circles, maybe because they're a part of the deaf community or they're a part of a community that of special needs. Regardless of what puts them in different social circles, are we willing to figure out how to go and share the gospel and disciple and send people in those communities? The last is people, or the E is people that are in different economic circumstances than we are. Understanding the difficulties of reaching people across the entire economic strata of our city, from poor to rich, from rich to poor, includes the rich reaching poor, but it includes the poor reaching rich and everything in between. And of course, the M is missions. Because we're not only to reach out to Jerusalem, the people that are near us and like us, to Judea and Samaria, the people that are near us but not so like us. We're supposed to reach out to those that are neither near us nor like us. Of course, this is a bit of an academic way to cover this subject matter. The kicker is that people land in multiple categories. Down at the end of anybody's street, you could have a high-class Hindu Indian prof that has migrated to the U.S. He lives down the street from where I live and might have a kid with Down syndrome. And the complexities of learning how to broach conversations of how God has changed our life and has offered them salvation as well is really complex. But separating our thoughts into these different categories allows us to bite-size our responsibilities for equipping and challenging people to understanding their own calling, their own heart, not just our church programming. Oftentimes, the problem of finishing the task is exacerbated as we narrowly define our roles in the Great Commission and we casually read through Acts 1:8, subtly replacing the ands with oars. And we get busy just in one lane at a time. As the local church, we bury our head and we restrict our energies to the needs that we see around us. This isn't always from a motivation of wanting to build our own kingdoms, and I don't think it's some abuse of power, but it still neglects the needs of our community. As the church plant, or the cross-cultural church, we are so overwhelmed by issues of poverty or maybe the lack of volunteers or the need to raise outside support that we can resent the larger church and we can't even think about sending even one of our key people abroad. And as the missionary organization, we end up focusing on the incredible statistic of lostness, sometimes forgetting the importance of engaging the existing church and communicating with them those that have sent us and the ways that we can help them raise laborers for all of these fields. So how do we navigate these tensions? First, I think by understanding the nature of God's threefold commission and committing ourselves to a strategy that helps make each one of these things a priority simultaneously. By keeping the Great Commission in front of our church as the ultimate strategy, we create the right goal and the right focus on all three audiences to flourish. Focusing on the Great Commission, it forces us to cultivate evangelism, discipleship, and church planting. And these are not what I would refer to as overflow skills, things that we get to once our church is running smoothly, but they're actually the building blocks of a healthy, thriving, lasting, and replicating church. And when we're committed to the ends of Acts 1:8, we have to do a better job of giving more, a better job than giving 51 sermons a year about our Jerusalem and then tagging on one missions emphasis week. Which brings me to today's contentious discussion. My subtitle. You want to know what my subtitle is by now? I hope you're waiting for it. My subtitle for this talk is You Can Always Pastor. You can always pastor. This was a phrase that I used as a missionary while recruiting people to the mission field, especially those who were content to stay within the American church. It kind of started out as a joke, and I would talk to a lot of people that said, I want to be a pastor. I said, you can always pastor. Why don't you come and spend a little time with us? But it got a little dicey when I started thinking about the pastorate myself and how much I learned as a missionary that makes me better at my job. Here's a few thoughts. The pastorate is a role that increases in effectiveness as education and experience go broader and go deeper. My role as a strategies pastor at Grace is predicated on having outside experiences that I can steward back into the church with a different way of looking at things. In a growing church, pastors can too easily solve problems just by hiring people, but missionaries have figured out that you have to have lay leaders that understand a vision-driven aspect of the organization that are willing to sacrifice. Not all problems can be solved by money. Becoming a missionary doesn't mean that you deny being a pastor. Get this, it just means that you stand in a less defined pulpit. And being a missionary moves you from an attractional strategy to a missional strategy, something to which too few churches have committed. You can always pastor. There is a bit of a double entendre there that we can't miss. The first is easiest, and we talked about it a little bit yesterday, and it's this, that really all jobs in the ministry, regardless of what that is, from admin to middle management, all the way to the director of a church, all of these different positions include pastoral behaviors in reaching out to those that are around us. But second, our focus today is to remind you that all other ministry roles can also benefit you in becoming a pastor or a church minister. I will even go as far to say that many of our churches suffer because of a limited experience in and therefore a value for what happens on the mission field. And when this is coupled with kind of a deadly overestimation of what can be accomplished just from a pulpit, the church suffers further. The irony is this, that many of you came to DTS to become ministers and pastors, but you spend most of your time poring through the epistles that were written by a missionary. Just think about that for a minute. Consider all the biblical leaders that are mentioned in the passages in the scriptures, and how many of them were actually missionaries or some of the prophets missionary-like, and how many of them were pastors, and out of the ones that were pastors, how many of those that were pastors are actually missionaries first? Future and current pastors, ministers, missionaries, and professors. There is something uniquely learned on the gospel frontier when no one is watching. That it decreases our self-dependence. It increases humility. It builds a desire for partnership. And it creates a clear understanding that the ministry does and has always belonged to Jesus. I have walked into places where my carnal soul cried out with complete insignificance. No one knows where I am. No one knows what I'm doing. No one knows what I'm saying. And it feels like I'm not making any difference at all. But those are the places where God met me. And he reminded me of the internal significance of working towards the completion of the task. And it buries something deep within our souls that it makes us better people. And it makes us better pastors. Now, I'm not saying that missionaries aren't treated well when they come back home. As a missionary, I have lived with part of my life where my reputation, okay, people saying, I can't believe how amazing you are, far exceeded my reality because they didn't actually know anything that I was doing. Where my purpose was far more popular than people's participation when it came to the work itself. It was like people chose to esteem me so highly that they could more easily excuse themselves from joining in. When I was dating my wife, I used to joke, everyone loves a missionary except a girlfriend's father, because they can see the cost coming. And I remember the day with my father-in-law standing with tears in his eyes as we carried off the number one grandson back on the plane at 6 weeks old to head back to what we called home. You can always pastor on the gospel frontier and after it, which leaves us with just a few questions. What will be your contribution to the gospel frontier? Can you feel the shared responsibility, or have you just decided to subcontract it to others? I'll close with a story which I hope highlights my point. When I was living overseas, I used to travel back to Texas quite a bit, recruiting in our partnership campuses. I would make stops at Rice, at TCU, at A&M, and at Texas University. We would always have the same conversations with students. As I sat down to challenge students, the conversation, no matter what we talked to, it always seemed to kind of culminate in this discussion the same way. And the comment would be made, I could never do what you do. And I would spend the next 20 minutes in a self-deprecating factor trying to explain to this person that missionaries were just people. Appointment after appointment, the same conversation to the same conclusion. But evidently one day I'd had enough. I was sitting in the flag room of the Memorial Student Center at Texas A&M, my alma mater, and a young student reflectively told me the same phrase, I could never do what you do. And evidently I paused just long enough to have a different answer pop into my head. I wasn't there to convince people what they should do. I was there to enable the right people to do what God was calling them to do. So really, honestly, with the kindest voice that I could muster, in the midst of my frustration, I simply said, "You're probably right." And after that pregnant pause, the student looked back to me and said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I repeated my answer. "You're probably right. You probably aren't suited to serve the Lord on the mission field, but I want to make sure you know why." I said, "It isn't because you haven't finished school. It isn't because you picked a bad major. It isn't because your parents are going to freak out. It isn't because you don't know your Bible as well as you should. It isn't because you have the wrong skills or can't get along with people or don't share your faith enough. The reason that you aren't suited to help fulfill the Great Commission on the gospel frontier is you just don't want to. To do what I'm recruiting people to do really takes one main thing. It's a life that's consecrated to the Lord and His purposes. That we would be compelled and controlled by Jesus to no longer live for ourselves, but for Him who dies for us. And then the rest comes easier. That student never joined us overseas. But I found a new gear that day. And I've never backed down from issuing a God-sized challenge to anybody who might be willing to listen. So here I am again. I'm sitting at my alma mater, speaking to the next generation of the best and the brightest, asking you if you have replaced the ands of Acts 1:8 with ors, falling into a default setting with a mind that you want to be a minister of the gospel and that your sacrifice is already great enough. I'm asking if you've considered the scope of the mission. 3 billion people who have yet to have a chance to hear a clear presentation of the gospel message. Can you honestly come before Him today being confident enough in your calling, having already put all and every option on the table, including some years overseas? Another way to ask this question is, if the Lord made it clear that He wanted you to give up whatever plans you've made and find a place among the unreached, would you be willing to serve? Would you be willing to go? And then ask yourself, what would that clarity look like? And then ask yourself, do you have the same level of clarity for the plan that you're already following? For many of you, maybe even for most of you, nothing needs to change. But for some of you, there's that growing, unsettling feeling that maybe has crept into your mind that you haven't looked at the breadth of the opportunities that fall within our responsibilities. It isn't that you've made a bad choice, but maybe that your process was limited just to known quantities. The understood experiences and expectations that are related to our own contributions. For while we prep and while we plan about the lives that we're going to live, almost half the world awaits, the feet of which carry good news. God did not call you to go and save them by yourselves, by the way, but He did call you to go or to send others who will tell them that Jesus did. Hear me clearly. I am not doubting the depth of your resolve. I am here to remind you of the scope of your responsibility. Your Jerusalem, people that are near you and people that are like you, and your Judea and Samaria, people that are near you and people that are not like you, and the ends of the earth. People that are not near you, nor people that are like you. It's the gospel frontier. Which brings us to our homework assignment. Can you identify one country with less than 2% evangelical presence that you can learn about, pray for, and imagine yourself in? And then ask the question, how could 3 to 5 years there help you in fulfilling your calling? I'll end with this. Some churches are started and led with a polite reference to the missional work of the Great Commission, while others are founded upon it for their very existence. As you prepare or continue your work as a leader of people, where will you end up in this key decision? Let me pray. Jesus, I pray that in this moment that you would make us incredibly aware of our surroundings, that there are those within the closest sphere of influence, that there are those that live kind of near us, but it just doesn't seem that I break into relationships with them without some extra effort or some extra initiation, and then the realization that the rest of the world is out there in different spiritual situations, different spiritual opportunities. And Lord, we desperately need you, not a conference, not a teacher, to put on our hearts the very calling of where it is that we need to go. Would you help us, Jesus, not to replace the ands with ors and to understand the scope of our entire responsibility? And we pray that we would do this to the glory of your name. Amen.